Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this extra episode, comic books are more popular now than they've ever been. Sales have been on the rise for years and keep climbing. They are also experiencing growth in diversity. One indication is the character Kamala Khan, the new Ms. Marvel. Khan is a Pakistani-American teenager, a shapeshifter, and a Muslim. One of her primary creators is the Seattle-based author Willow Wilson. Bringing a young woman, a person of color, and a practicing Muslim into the superhero fold has been both a huge success and a substantial challenge. Not all comic book fans applauded the move. Negative trolling has been common. In this conversation, Wilson discusses how she became the person who could reincarnate a modern Ms. Marvel. She was raised an atheist and converted to Islam. She lived in Egypt in her 20s, where she worked as a journalist. Her experience highlights cultural progress and setbacks in the realms of diversity, religious tolerance, and gender equality. Willow Wilson spoke with KUOW's Jamala Henderson at the Langston Hughes Performing Arts Institute on October 23rd. Humanities Washington hosted the conversation. Jenny Cecil Moore recorded the discussion.
I'm just really excited to be able to sit down and talk with G. Willow Wilson. And just so you know, the G is silent. I learned this the other day. It's a wonderful thing. So I'm just going to call her Willow. And I'm really excited about this.
You've had the right idea about the mics.
And thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate this.
No, thank you for coming out and doing this. It's a lot less intimidating to be on a stage when you're up there with somebody whose voice you hear on the radio every day.
Oh, this is a lot of fun. And just another shout out to Geek Girl Con. Willow and I actually ran into each other at Geek Girl Con as we were sort of drooling over all of the wonderful things that they have in the concession area.
Merchandise.
Yes. So it was fun to run into you there as well. So I'm just going to start out with kind of talking a little bit about what people may have seen on the Humanities Washington website when they looked to see what this event was about. There's a blurb that kind of describes you in this way, and it says that you lie at the epicenter of multiple fault lines of American identity. And I'm kind of wondering how you feel about that description of yourself right now as you're walking through the world today.
So I first read that blurb because one of my dedicated trolls on Twitter posted it and said, "This sounds like cancer." And so I looked at it and I was like, gosh, what is he talking about? Okay, I'm going to click this link. And so I clicked it and I read it and I was like, oh my God, it kind of does. But not in the way that he probably meant. It's interesting to me to hear that particular turn of phrase used simply because from my own perspective, what I do and sort of who I am isn't really at the epicenter of much of anything. You know, I think of myself as being more on the periphery of several things than at the center of anything, simply because my own experiences don't really transfer in any great way. I don't know that there are any particularly wide-ranging lessons that one can take from my experience and then apply to the American Muslim community as a whole, because most American Muslims are not white converts. I don't think, also, on the other hand, you know, I sort of, by doing something that is sort of considered radical and bizarre, in converting to a religion that is, to put it mildly, very contentious in the U.S., I sort of diverged from the trajectory that most of my friends who are from similar backgrounds were on. And so I'd sort of come to think of myself over the years as being on the periphery, which has its own unique vantage point, but is not at the center of any one particular thing in a way that could speak authoritatively for that thing.
So when you say you're on the periphery, what are you feeling like you are on the periphery of?
I think, you know, pretty much every way, you know, every bit of my identity is modified in some way. Mm. You know, I'm a Muslim. I've been a Muslim for my whole adult life. But, you know, I did not grow up in the faith. And so that's very different from somebody who did, you know, whether they're practicing or not. In most spaces like the ones in which I grew up, I'm sort of considered a bit of a traitor, because, you know, Islam is not seen as a neutral thing to adopt. It's seen as inherently political or inherently making a certain sort of statement, if not downright antisocial in some way and antithetical to what it means to be American. And, you know, when I'm in Egypt, obviously, I'm in the religious majority, and that's where I learned to practice the faith, and so that sort of informs my own practice. But at the same time, I'm a foreigner, and, you know, that comes with certain privileges and also certain boundaries. Mm. And so that's sort of what I've gotten used to until very, very recently, when it seems like there's a great deal of pressure on lots of people to be spokespeople for their faith, their gender, their background, their culture, their community. And given the fact that I am not at the center of any of those communities, I get very, very nervous when I'm sort of set up as being the representative of X. Because most of my experiences are non-representative. And what I've been trying to do since there is this now great interest in these sort of facets of identity politics is say, well, you know whose experience is more representative, like this person over here, you know? And so I do a lot of that now. A lot of redirecting is like, no, you don't actually want me for this. You want this other person. I'll introduce you. And so it's when I hear those words, I'm like, oh God. because, you know, because those experiences don't really translate.
And what when you speak about redirecting people to, you know, be a better representative of what it is that they may be looking to you for, we talked a little bit earlier about this. You had an experience with the release of your very first book where mm-hmm. there was a really huge lesson that you took away from your experience dealing with, you know, the audience of when it was published. Would you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So the first nonfiction book, well, the first book without pictures that I ever published was The Butterfly Mosque, mm-hmm. which was autobiographical. It grew out of emails and sort of... we weren't even really calling it blogging back then, but blog post type things that I had been writing while I was living in Egypt. And I'd kind of compiled them you know, several people have said, well, why don't you just sort of, you know, make a book out of it? Because it was a time that was very fraught. It was the middle of the Iraq War. 9/11 was still fresh in everybody's mind. And the thought that my agent had and you know, editors and people who were involved with the book is, well, maybe talking about Islam from your perspective will sort of hit home for like a white Christian audience in a way that others might not, because your background is similar to theirs. And so maybe, you know, you'll be able to have conversations with that audience that other people who have tried to kind of bridge that ideological gap have not been successful in doing. And, you know, being young and naive, I was like, well, yeah, I'll give it a shot. Why not? Let's try. And then the book came out. And, you know, I did a book tour, and I did several community reading type events. And what I discovered at these events was that the complete opposite was true. Mm. That because I was from a similar background to these sort of, you know, WASPier audiences, they saw me as inherently traitorous. That what I had done was a betrayal on a very intimate level of what they believe themselves to be. And this crossed political lines. This is not a left-right thing. You know, they might use different words. And still to this day, I get some of these comments that, you know, the people on the right wing would be more likely to use a word like traitor. People who were leftist or consider themselves leftist would use words like pervert, which is interesting. We could unpack that for days. and it was kind of an interesting rude awakening for me to have that experience and to realize, and that was kind of the beginning of the realization that I was not going to be central to these conversations. And that actually someone who grew up in the faith, who was maybe from an immigrant background or had grown up here in the United States in the religion, was much better suited to have those conversations, because those people who needed to hear it understand the duty to the past. They understand culture. They understand loyalty to family. And when you couch the conversation about pretty much anything, but in this case, Islam, in that context, they are much more likely to say, okay, maybe we might still hate your religion, but we understand why it is that you believe these things, and that there's some commonality there in the thinking that, that culture is something very important, and you know, even if it doesn't make a whole ton of sense. So I stopped doing pretty much all interfaith stuff, or sort of overtly interfaith stuff, and doing exactly what we were talking about. You know, when I would get asked, oh, do you want to do this interfaith thing? I would say, you don't want that baggage. You know, let me point you to this speaker, you know, who can do a much better job with this audience. It was a big, it was a real awakening in terms of, okay, here's where you stand.
That's an incredible story to me. And it's sad to have that sort of realization happen to you at that time, but it makes me wonder about how you deal with that, besides, you know, sort of redirecting that conversation to other people who you think might be more suitable for those kinds of conversations. I mean, one of the things that goes through my head is, you know, there are in people, you know, for audiences, for people of color that I think of, friends of mine who talk about being burdened with having mm-hmm. to do a lot of educating or explaining of, you know, their experience or what it is like to kind of walk through the world looking how they look or being who they are. And so I wonder what you think is a balance for that kind of conversation.
I think it's really contextual. You know, I'm happy to browbeat audiences about what they're doing wrong. That's fine with me. I will totally do that. And, you know, those conversations, those angry ones, I'm happy to have. But I think, you know, when it comes to issues of experience, you cannot swap one life for another. Or pretend that the experience of a convert is the same as the experience of a Somali refugee, mm-hmm. and that those things are interchangeable. And that, in fact, assuming that interchangeability is part of the reason that we've remained in this loop, because we like to essentialize groups of people and kind of distill them down to like a little, you know, a little takeaway, a little soundbite. Mm-hmm. And that's dangerous. So it really depends. On what the goal or the outcome of the conversation is meant to be, who has the desire to have those conversations and who don't, and who doesn't. Oh my God. they pay me to write. This is incredible. I can't even get out a grammatically correct sentence.
We're all friends here. It's all
because, you know, there are people for whom that is a calling. And there are people who are like, no, I don't want this. This is emotionally taxing. I shouldn't have to do it. And so I think it really, really has to do with the context. What conversation is it? What is the desired outcome? You know, is the person in the conversation or on the stage being offered up as a sacrificial lamb? Or is there real room for something actually productive? And I think a lot of that goes into, you know, who ends up doing what. But obviously, you know, I wouldn't pass the mic to somebody who had not said specifically to me, like, you know, because there are people now who do this, like, this mm-hmm. is what they do, this is their job. Mm-hmm. And I certainly wouldn't just sort of foist something like that on an unsuspecting friend Absolutely. Who was not interested.
Absolutely. You grew up in a household that was atheist, mm-hmm. which I find fascinating. And I'm wondering what kinds of conversations that you had with your parents, you know, about what atheism actually was. I grew up in a household that was very Christian, mm-hmm. so it was kind of pushed in that
right.
in that direction. But I sort of chose to walk away from that, yeah. And you chose to walk towards a faith. So we sort of have opposite paths, and I'm curious yeah. what your upbringing in that atheist environment did for you that led you to find Islam.
I tell people that I did try to be an atheist. I was just never very good at it. You know, but it I think faith is irrational. There are lots of people today trying to sell the idea that faith can be attained rationally. I think they are all full of you-know-what. I mean, not maybe them as people, but I think their ideology is kind of you-know-what. Faith is something much more like love. You know, you cannot explain your way into love. I think sometimes you can probably explain your way out of it, but you certainly can't explain your way into it. And I think faith as something felt is really kind of the same way. It's kind of there, or it's not. And if you grow up in sort of a faith-based environment, you know, the particular ideas of your parents or your community can influence how that is expressed. But I don't think you can sort of engender faith out of thin air where there is none. Mm-hmm. And so in my case, if there is a God gene or genes, I just have it. You know, it's just there. And so for me, to grow up in an environment where it was sort of human life was considered this trajectory, and religion was something that we had to kind of get through as a species before we arrived at this enlightened state of atheism, which miraculously involved having the same five middle-aged white guys in charge who had been in charge forever. I mean, it was kind of miraculous. But, you know, it was seen as a natural evolution, and to go back to religion was backsliding or evidence of intellectual deficiency or perversion of some kind. This word gets used a lot in relation to my choices. This is why I bring it up. I don't think it's necessarily a good descriptor of a lot of things. But and so it really, for most of my childhood and young adulthood, faith sort of or God felt like something very, very taboo and kind of shameful. Mm. It was like, I'll make this metaphor. Let's say every time you said, I love X, somebody said, love is not a real thing. What you are feeling is a certain release of hormones and neurotransmitters in your brain to facilitate social bonding. And you're like, okay, all right. I'm feeling a release of certain neurotransmitters to facilitate social bonding. Yes. And every time you tried to say the word love, it was, no, that is not love. There is no such thing as love. Mm. That's what it was like. You know, if there are atheist parents out there who would like their kids to preferably end up atheist and would like to avoid this, I can give you some advice. So it really was, for me, a matter of getting to the point where I could either pursue faith as a thing and start using the word God unironically, or I could sort of begin to lose my grasp on my own sanity and sense of self. Mm. That's very particular, you know, like it doesn't necessarily translate to, to
what
somebody else's experience. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I was just thinking it could be hard for someone maybe to wrap around, just to wrap around their mind around the idea of why you would want to, you know, you've been raised in an atheist household and mm-hmm. that you would choose to convert to Islam in our culture that we live in now. we're just exposed to so many negative, you know, stereotypes and ideas about Islam and the Muslim faith in general. But you talked about why a lot of this in your memoir, The Butterfly Mosque, and you talked about the difficulty that you had of having conversations with some friends and family, and I'm wondering how those conversations have changed over the years. Are you still having them, and are they still difficult, or have they gotten easier?
You know, that's an interesting question. I do still have them, but typically now I'm having them with people I've known for shorter periods of time. You know, the people who thought I was no longer worth knowing once I had converted are now more or less gone. I mean, not dead, but they're out of my life. Mm-hmm. so there's sort of a sorting, natural sorting that has taken place over the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. But I do still occasionally have those conversations with people I've just met or know in some different context. I will say they were hard for a while, but then ironically, over the course of the past couple of years, things have gotten so bad that these conversations have actually gotten a lot easier, especially because there are now alliances across boundaries in this country that didn't exist before. I remember at the very beginning of my career in comics, I got this most amazing hate mail. I kept it because it was so extraordinary. Every line was like a different color and a different font.
Oh.
It was a work of art. And this person accused me of being part of the, I'm trying to get this exactly right, the socialist, homosexual, Islamic attack on American values. And I was like, wow, that is not a real thing. But it sounds fabulous. And it was, you know, I filed it away. I was like, who could possibly think that all of these things, like, these are diametrically opposed ideas here. Like, what the hell is going on? But then, you know, we came to our current catastrophe. And because there was so much pressure against so many groups that, you know, now the conversations have changed very radically. And it's assumed that somebody like me is, in fact, part of the actual, real, and now very much existent socialist, homosexual, Muslim attack on American values. And I kind of love it. so, you know, like it was sort of like this imaginary thing that was made real by the people who feared it. So my hat is off to them. I didn't think I'd see it in my lifetime. But they did it. I mean, it's so now it's easier because it's not assumed that, you know, if you wear a headscarf, you are automatically homophobic because you have women in headscarves marching in LGBTQ rights parades, and, you know, we all realize that we have to get each other's backs, and it's changed things.
Mm-hmm. And we see so many differences now with how a lot of these divisions are happening and or communities are coming together. Right,
yeah.
to make sure that keeps happening. And what's interesting to me is the way that person described that is very different from how you describe coming to Islam and your faith as a Muslim. There's this wonderful passage in your memoir, and it's where you are kind of describing how you came to the faith after one of your friends asked you, why Islam? So I'm going to read this passage to you now.
I'm just going to sit here and wince because I wrote this when I was 23.
We went back and forth. Who's going to read this? I'll go ahead and do it. So I discovered I was a monotheist. That rules out polytheism. I have also had a problem with authority, which rules out any religion with a priesthood or leader who claims to be God's representative on earth. And I cannot believe that having given us these bodies, God thinks we should be virgins unless we desperately feel a need to reproduce. That rules out any religion that's against family planning or sex for fun rather than procreation. Islam is an anti-authoritarian, sex-positive monotheism.
Man, I should have... Anyway.
It's very... Well, and so my next question is basically, do you still feel that way, or how has that... evolved since you've written that.
On some level, certainly, yeah. I don't know that I would have packaged it in that particular way. I mean, it's when I was writing this, I was number one very young. I mean, like, if you can't be wildly optimistic when you're 23, what is the point of being 23, really? But, you know, so my ideas about a lot of things have sort of tempered with age and humor, which tends to come with age. I make myself sound ancient. I just turned 35. I'm really not that old. I feel that old, though. So, you know, it's I would say that certainly there are ideas that you can take away from the religion that are certainly that. And, you know, in a place like Egypt or even Iran, which are very conservative, two very different forms of Islam, but still, you know, where Islam is the religion of the state, you can walk into a pharmacy as a woman and buy birth control pills. No fuss, no muss, nobody cares, nobody's going to look down their nose at you. You know, they might glance at your hand to see if you're wearing a wedding ring and sort of like give you the side eye if you're not. But no, you know, like in Egypt, when I was living there, you could walk into a pharmacy without a prescription and get birth control pills that would set you back like maybe $2. So
very
certainly,
different idea of what a lot of us have of, you know,
yeah,
being
very different,
very different,
very different. You know, and it's sort of taken for granted that you know, sex is primarily for fun, because the trajectory of the development of the philosophy of the religion was just on a completely different path than, say, Western Christianity. And I don't want to be unfair to Western Christianity either. That's a lot of things, and you could talk to five different Christians and you know, get four who said, like, yes, we are very sex positive, and another one who says something completely different. So, you know, I don't want to disparage any other form of faith, but I mean, there were things that even to me as a convert were shocking, living in the Muslim world, like that I sort of assumed, because culturally I was working from a Christian standpoint, that anything that would be sort of censured here by religious conservatives or cultural conservatives would likewise be censured there, but more so. So to, you know, like, be walking along Tahrir Square, the site of the famous revolution, and go by this like lingerie store with like edible underwear advertised, like sitting there in the window, and, you know, women and men and everybody sort of stopping and looking and being like, you know, women dressed like me, looking and being like, oh look, edible underwear. I was kind of blown away. I was like, how do these two, I don't understand, because we're so hardwired to think that religion means a particular thing. Mm. And, you know, even after I had begun to practice, I was still surprised by how many things were different.
Mm. What was the most surprising thing besides edible underwear?
Besides the edible, on display in Tahrir Square. Oh my gosh. Gosh, if I had to pick
maybe
one.
Maybe that was the most surprising thing.
That was, I mean, you know, on a... I have to say, this is not religious, but this was a culture shock thing. Turning on the Hezbollah channel and seeing the dancing clown in the children's hour was that's when I knew I was no longer in the United States. but yeah, I mean, it was really kind of an awakening for me, which is why I think a lot of Butterfly Mosque comes off as so perky, because I was like, this is amazing. Like, all the things that I have been told about this part of the world are completely the opposite. But some of the things are still true. And, you know, you don't want to oversell the way those differences at the expense of pointing out that there are real and deep and abiding flaws that do not go away just by sort of lacquering over them.
Based on what you said, I'm going to look back at my 20s and be much kinder to my 20-year-old self. Thank you very much for that. And just kind of moving on to your days of becoming a journalist and living in Egypt and doing some very serious reporting there, I'm wondering if
I don't know if I'd call it very serious. Mildly serious, maybe.
I consider that serious. When you look back on that time, what are some of the most potent takeaway lessons for you about writing true stories about that, you know, that place in the world at that time?
You know, that was really probably the one situation in which being on the periphery, not being in the midst of any one particular community, really, really worked to a certain advantage, because I could go into buildings that all the other Western reporters I knew could not go into. Because in Egypt, especially during prayer times, mosques that are not historical buildings, in other words, they're not like cathedral equivalents, are closed to tourists. To non-Muslims, foreigners living there as well. And I could go into those places. So I had access to people who other journalists that I knew did not have access to. And I could talk to them, number one, in Arabic, but also from a perspective that was kind of hard to get. And I didn't do breaking news. I did cultural stories. My big scoop while I was there was I got to do the first English language interview of the then Grand Mufti of Egypt after he was made Grand Mufti. That was interesting, and that got picked up by The Atlantic. Mm-hmm. Who had no idea what a hack I was.
No.
It really was interesting to be able to tell those stories because I was like, really, there is no zealot like a convert. So I'd go to interviews and I would bring a mahram with me. I would bring either my husband or my father-in-law, two of the most extraordinary men I've ever met. My father-in-law, to whom the book is dedicated, died shortly after we moved here. And people would sort of be stunned. They would be like, what is this? Because most Egyptian journalists would not follow those like very religious protocols anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, a lot of people found that sort of charming or weird enough that they would like open up in a way that they might not have to somebody else. They were like, you're so weird. Like, I don't even know what I should say and not say around you. And it really worked because people would open up and I could get snippets of something very real because I couldn't be located, you know, sort of within anything really. Mm. And it was really kind of extraordinary, but a lot of pressure at the same time because, you know, there's a lot that goes into making, you know this, you're an expert in this, real stories fit into a 3-act structure that people's brains can sort of glom onto. Mm-hmm. Because real life does not work in a 3-act structure. But stories kind of have to. And I find it very unnerving because at many, many points, I would be pressured to make those stories fit in ways that I found bordered on dishonesty. Mm-hmm. And that's ultimately why I stopped. Typically, even editors at very wonderful, highly respected, politically whatever newspapers would give a story.
An edit.
And yeah, well, they would give you an assignment. Assignment. That's.
Oh right. Yes. Okay.
Again, they pay me to write this stuff. they would give assignments and already have an idea in their minds of how they wanted it to turn out with a particular spin. Mm-hmm. And it was impossible to get away from and really, really began to rub me the wrong way.
I understand that.
Yeah.
I understand that.
I know you do.
I mean, it can be difficult to get all the different sort of complex little details into those stories that you would really like them to have to kind of give people the bigger picture, but you are condensed to a shorter amount of time or a certain amount of words or... you know, somebody's preconceived notion of what that story should be versus what you
what
have
it turns
seen,
out to be.
Yeah. What it turns out to be or what you have seen. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's the perfect segue into the question that I had for you, which was how did you find yourself transitioning from journalism into comics? Because I'm thinking, wow. I mean, what a jump, what a leap. But
for me it felt very natural. I've been a comics geek since I was about 10 years old. I grew up with 90s X-Men. the Chris Claremont books, the Fox Kids cartoon, which, don't go back and watch it again. I made that mistake. The magic was gone. It was... Yeah, I mean, yeah. You get down the line and something happened with the production or they moved the studio somewhere and you're like, what is happening here? But no, I mean, it was like, I mean, talk about a religious experience. For 10-year-old me and 11-year-old me, X-Men was like church. I mean, it was like, I vividly remember being, I must have been 11 or 12-ish. Yeah, maybe 11. And this was right at the beginning of, you know, Bush 1, Iraq War 1, the prequel, you know, and they interrupted...
The Phantom Menace.
And it was Saturday morning, and X-Men was due to come on, and there was George H.W., not W., on the screen making some sort of, you know, giving like a press thing, briefing about the war. And I was like, oh my God, stop. Oh my God, X-Men is supposed to be on. What are you doing? And then, you know, it went over and it went off the air and I was like, oh, please tell me they're not just gonna skip it, and they skipped it. And like literally, the pain stayed with me for weeks and is tangible to this day. But, you know, I'd always loved comics. In high school, I sort of transitioned to sort of the gothier British invasion stuff that was coming out at the time. You know, Sandman, Shade the Changing Man.
Oh, yeah.
Which is one of the best series of all times. You want to talk about before its time. I mean, like, Shade was so far before its time that people read it and they were like, what even is this? But you read it today and you're like, oh, my God, it's like you look 30 years into the future. So it's really amazing. And so I knew that I wanted to write comics, but then as now it was not entirely clear how one does that. Because, you know, in regular publishing, it's very straightforward. You write a book, you send it to an agent, the agent says yes or no, and then if they say yes, they'll send it to publishers who then say yes or no. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's like not all that different, honestly, from applying for college. But comics functions much more like film. It's much more of a handshake business. It's more about who you know. And so if you were like me and knew no one and nothing, like Jon Snow, you were kind of like, how do I make this happen? So I'd actually written the script for what would eventually become Cairo, my first graphic novel, before I was doing any journalism of any kind. But it just kind of sat there for several years because I had nobody to send it to. Because I didn't know how you even did that. Like, how do you send an editor? Do you send them to editors? Do you send scripts to editors? Is that even a thing that happens? Wow. And it took a long process of, you know, I had met Keith Giffen in college when I was interning for one of the very earliest digital comic book companies. And he had an editor who was at DC, but in the superhero sort of world, and like, so he said, I like this, can I show it to my editor? And I said, sure. And he showed it to her, she was like, I like this, but this isn't superhero stuff, I don't do superheroes, let me give it to Karen Berger. She gave it to Karen Berger. Karen Berger was like, I don't know this person. So it sat on her desk for a long time. So really, there was like a period of about 3 years, comprising like pretty much the sum total of my very short career in journalism when I was trying to get a comic book published. And the takeaway from that is, it is easier to get published in the New York Times than it is to publish a single volume of comics.
Wow.
And I know that firsthand.
Well, obviously it was meant to happen.
I guess.
Because it did, eventually.
No, it still bugs me because now there are a lot of people. I'm just going to open this up like this. I'm sorry.
Why don't you let me? Oh, you have it.
It's all right. Yeah, I think I've figured it out. There are a lot of people now, and especially younger kids who are in middle and high school, who are like, I want to write comics or I want to draw comics. Mm-hmm. How do I do that? And I do not have a career path to give to them.
It seems like...
Which is not right.
It seems nebulous. It seems like a very difficult industry to break into. So
yeah.
That's why I was so curious to know. How do you take journalism into comics?
Yeah, you know? it was like 6 degrees of separation. but if you don't have that first degree, mm-hmm. it's very, very difficult to make that jump. So I really, really hope, this is not going to happen, but I really, really wish that the big comic book publishers would make some sort of open submissions policy, or at least clarify the submission policy, you know, so that we, you know, so that there's more new talent can move into the industry.
Yeah. So I just want to throw out a little prompt for those in the audience. We're at about 8:20, 8:21, I think now. And we're gonna leave the last 20, 25 minutes or so for audience questions. So get them ready and we'll be coming to you for your questions. But until then, I wanna talk a little bit about Ms. Kamala Khan, Ms. Marvel. I really love that comic, I just have to tell you. And I'm wondering, what's her origin story? How did that come to be within Marvel and, you know, make it to the real world? Because it's an amazing thing to have out there in our culture right now, to kind of see these, you know, amazing stories come to an audience that, you know, everyone can kind of grasp what it's like to have all this, the diversity within Islam and Muslim culture.
So the way that all started was I got a call really out of the blue in, it must have been 2011 or early 2012 from Sana Aminat at Marvel and Stephen Wacker, who at that point was her editor. And at that point they were both working in the X-Men office. The X-Men office is a thing.
That's totally cool.
It is a thing. And they cold called me. I had done almost nothing for Marvel that year. I'd done like a little short with Ming Doyle for Girl Comics. And I guess I had done Mystic the year before, but I really had done almost nothing in comics at all for about a year because I'd written Aleph. I went on a very long book tour with that. I had two books and two babies within the space of 20 months.
So you really had four babies.
Really, I had four babies. They were not all planned to sort of come out in that order. But that's how it happened. but so that's what I was doing. And they literally called me one day out of the blue. I was like lactating. And I had like an ice pack up. This is way too much information. This is what happens when I do events in Seattle. I'm like, I probably know half of you. It's like, we're all friends. I can give you the gory details. And so they called me and they were like, okay, here's this pitch. We want to create a new YA American Muslim superheroine and put her on her own ongoing series. Would you develop the character and write the series?
So they already had it in mind.
Well, that's all they had. There was no name, no background, no power set, no, I mean, she wasn't even Ms. Marvel at that point. So she didn't even have like a code name. It was just that's all it was. And it had evolved from conversations that Sana and Steve had about Sana's childhood. She would apparently tell him stories about, you know, like the funny things and the tragedy and the stuff of her own childhood as, you know, a first generation American with immigrant parents and everything that entailed. And they were like, let's see, are there any Muslim women who write superhero comics in North America? There is one. And they were like, really? There was only one person we could call for this. So here we are. And I almost cracked up laughing. I was like, you guys, you don't really want to write this. You don't want this series, right? And I told them, I was like, you are going to have to hire an intern to open all the hate mail. Like, just a hate mail intern. Because, you know, these were the days of the, like, you know, socialist homosexual attack on American values. You know, like, this was the mail that I got on, like, a weekly basis. I was like, this is, and it was for writing Superman, having nothing to do with anything about Islam or anything else. My presence in the industry was considered a form of like stealth jihad or like a, no, that's a real term. Like that is a non-ironic term used by, you know, those we do not speak of. So that was really it. But I was like, I cannot believe that Marvel is pitching me this book. Like this, I would never pitch this book in a million years because it's the trifecta of death, as I called it. The prevailing wisdom at the time said that new characters do not sell, female characters do not sell, and minority characters do not sell. And this was all three. I was like, we are going to sell a grand total of 2,000 copies, and that's like including our friends and family, and you know, get nominated for one Eisner, which we will not win, and then go back to doing what we've always been doing. But they were like, no, we're going to do it. We're going to put some muscle behind it. It's going to be great. It's going to have the support of the PR team. So I was like, all right. And then Sana and I spent 18 flipping months almost developing this character. Wow. And she was like, she could be anything. She said, Willow, you can make her a convert if you want. And I was like, no, because by that time I had learned, like, this is not going to be useful to people. And it's going to seem evangelical. Because, you know, no matter how we couch it, it's going to seem like we're saying, like, convert to Islam and you too can have superpowers. So that was a non, that was, I was like, I'm flattered, but that's we don't want that headache. So we went back and forth for a long time until I was like, finally, like, Sana, this whole thing was inspired by conversations you had about your childhood with Steve. Why are we overthinking this? Let's just make her a Pakistani American. And that way, if you think I'm full of you know what, you can just put the brakes on. And it sort of came from there. And Jersey City was, for me, then inevitable because I thought, okay, the setting is going to have as much significance as anything else. Because this is going to be a junior superhero. She's got no bona fides in the superheroing community. You know, she's going to be very DIY. We'd had long conversations about, okay, how does she get her costume? And I'd be like, can't we do like the hand wavy stuff that everybody always does in these series? And so I was like, nope, game it all the way out. And I was like, Jersey City is perfect because everybody loves to hate New Jersey. I'm a Jersey girl. Sana was a Jersey girl. So we communed over being Jersey girls. You know, if I talk too long, the Jersey starts to come out. But it made so much sense because you could see Manhattan, which is the epicenter of the Marvel universe. Wow. And yet you're apart from it. Mm-hmm. You're sort of in this backwater. And there is a large, vibrant, historically significant Pakistani Muslim community there. So I was like, perfect. And that's when it really all clicked, because it's not just the character, it's the setting, it's the family, it's the whole thing. And now all of those things, and Jersey City in particular, have become so tightly connected to that character that I cannot write an arc outside of Jersey City. Like, I've pitched Sana, I was like, let's send her to space. And Sana's like, no. I'm like, oh, I love Jersey City, you love Jersey City. Like, literally, they've painted a mural in the hallway of the school upon which her school is based, but like, let's do something else. And Sana's like, no. Wow. It was, yeah, it was just, that's when it was magic.
That's really great. I have a question here from my beautiful friend and coworker, Amina Al-Sadi, who is a producer at KUOW Public Radio, and we're all fans of your comic. But she wanted to know, there are as many types of Muslim American girls as there are fingerprints. And, you know, so there's a lot of diversity in the community, as there is in a lot of different communities, but we don't really get to see that diversity portrayed in our media that often. Mm-hmm. And so, how do you handle putting, you know, the pressure of creating that pop culture character that's portraying such an underrepresented group? I mean, you yourself said you're getting all this hate mail already. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, did the hate mail change once that comic come out? Or,
no, I mean, it was kind of more of the same, except more urgent, because they're like, oh my God! Now there's Iron Man has been involved, and oh, like, now it's serious. Now you're playing with our toys. So it was, it didn't really change. But Sana and I mean, there was a lot of anxiety, and it would not have, like, this would not have been the same, I think, without the exact team that we had with Sana sort of at the helm and Adrian doing those, you know, first amazing arcs and setting the tone and all of that. Because, like, you know, Sana and I could talk about all of these anxieties and not need to sort of hold each other's hand. Like, we both knew sort of what the score was. And there was a lot of pressure for Kamala to be a certain way. Mm. You know, like, there was sort of two ways, really, that most positive, in heavy air quotes, Muslim characters, Muslim girls, are portrayed in the media. One is, like, the picture-perfect Muslim girl. Like, she wears a headscarf in exactly the right way. There's never any tension. There are no problems. You know, there's magically no racism anywhere. Everybody loves everybody. Everybody gets along. Everything is fine. That's one. The other one is the character is rebelling against this oppressive family structure / religion. Her father either wants to chop off body parts or force her into marriage or whatever, or send her back to some undisclosed country. And
Law and order.
Yes.
Special victims unit.
Yes. You're that, you're the model minority, or you're the SVU episode.
Yeah.
And
well, I those was just thinking, I saw that SVU episode. So.
Yeah. There's probably several. Yeah. Yeah. So it's, you know, and I think the burden of representation that goes into a character from a massively underrepresented group is that they are expected to be all things to all people. Mm-hmm. And they can't be. And they shouldn't be. Because what you want is a real character who feels singular and specific and particular. And you can't do that by just sort of making them be a pastiche of everybody. So what we did was, Kamala is a very particular way, mm-hmm. But we surrounded her with other kinds of Muslims. Mm-hmm. She's got this older brother who's sort of coded as Salafi. You know, like, he's very strict, very observant, but he's a good guy. Mm-hmm. He sticks up for her. There's real love there, even though they don't get along all the time. You know, like, her parents have different ideas. They're not identical to each other. Mm-hmm. It was really important to me to portray Muslim men in nuanced, loving roles because, mm-hmm. I mean, we talk about Muslim women being 2D, but Muslim men, 100% of the time, even if they're, like, positive, are terrorism adjacent in some way. Mm. So having a sheikh who was not, you know, terrorism adjacent, a dad, a brother who were not terrorism adjacent, was super, super important. You know, and we'd have different kinds of Muslim girls, too. Mm-hmm. You know, like, her best friend, Nakia, is, like, this sort of woke hijabi who's, like, into, I mean, like, and this sort of came about before this was really a cultural phenomenon, mm-hmm. but just based on people that I knew. So, because, again, I wanted to say, well, I wanted her to have a friend who wears hijab, but is not necessarily, again, that picture perfect, whatever, that maybe she has reasons for what she does that are not strictly religious and that she has a political ideology and all of this stuff. So you can surround the character with people who are very different, but mm-hmm. the character themselves has to be specific.
That's wonderful. And a lovely way of being able to give us that much more of a look of what the community is like that surrounds her so that you get more of an idea of what she's coming from mm-hmm. as a character.
That's it for this extra from Speakers Forum. Willow Wilson spoke with KUOW's Jamala Henderson at the Langston Hughes Performing Arts Institute on October 23rd. Thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. You'll find the full recording on our website, kuow.org. Thanks for listening. Tune in again soon.